The Black Shore Arts Hour.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Black Shore Arts Hour. It is me, Ellie, and I am joined by, of course, the lovely Matt Boothman.
Hello.
We're both here. It's very exciting. We have got a jam-packed show for you today. It's full of jam. It's some kind of flavour that you're going to love.
What kind of jam? Whatever flavour, it's my jam.
It's your jam.
Yeah.
It's Matt Boothman's jam, everybody. So, we have got a film review, of course. We've also got a lot of stuff about Frankie Fightwell.
Because it's coming up.
It's so soon.
We can't stop talking about it.
Upon this very recording, 'tis 3 weeks to the day. So, that is soonsies.
It's barreling along.
It is. If you want to buy tickets, go to blackshoreonline.com. It's on the 11th and 12th of May. I'm sure that information will be repeated several times throughout this show. So, first of all, Matt, we'll do what we normally do. It's going to be this.
The Matt Boothman Film Review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
What are you reviewing for us today, please?
Shh. It's a quiet place.
To conduct the whole thing with whispering.
I think if we were going to do that, we'd have to do stage whispers, wouldn't we? Otherwise, yeah. It's not going to get picked up.
Like, my mum's kind of whispering. Have you got? I think a lot of mums do this. Her whispering's louder than her talking. Possibly louder than her shouting.
Ooh, yeah, that's an impressive feat.
Yeah, it's the same as the her little run that she does when she's late for something is slower than her walking pace.
I mean, it's an impressive feat, but it's one that would get you killed in the world of A Quiet Place.
It would. Tell us all about it, Matt.
So this is it's a horror movie. It's a kind of a soft apocalypse movie. So the soft apocalypse is this
soft
kind
apocalypse.
Of, yeah, it's this subgenre of apocalypse stories where it's not like there was a big cataclysm and boom and everything was destroyed and now it's all mutants.
Light off of dinosaurs.
Yeah. It's a gradual decline, and you know there are some institutions and aspects of life that remain unchanged, but the world is clearly in a downslope and is heading towards ending. So yeah. What has happened here is there are monsters around. We don't know where they came from. It's never explained. Maybe they're aliens. Maybe they're not. But they're blind, but they have incredible hearing. Yeah. And they're very fast and very violent, and if they detect sound, they will run towards it and kill whatever made the sound and eat it, presumably.
Yeah. They get real mad about the sounds.
Yeah, so you get this this world of shocking contrasts where everything seems very peaceful until there are these sudden outbursts of incredible violence.
Mm.
We follow a family, the Abbotts, John Krasinski, who also directs, as the dad, Emily Blunt as the mum, and Millicent Simmonds as the eldest daughter is sort of particularly notable as well for reasons we'll go into in a mo. And it basically just follows them trying to survive and follows through all the horrible implications of what at first seems like a sort of situation that you could maybe deal with, like living very quietly. It feels on first blush like something you could probably manage.
Yeah.
But then it goes into the implications like the survivability of newborn children, for instance, is particularly significant.
Mm-hmm.
All the precautions that it's necessary to take. So there are lovely little details like the fact that the family don't eat off plates with cutlery. They eat with their fingers off like little knitted woolen mats because everything has to be geared towards making the least sound possible.
Yeah.
So it's heavily implied that although we never get any kind of flashbacks to how any of this went down, that the reason this particular family survived and continues to survive as long as they do is because Reagan, the eldest daughter, played by Millicent Simmonds, is deaf.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole family have learned American Sign Language in order to communicate on a bit more of a level with her. So they're able to cooperate and communicate and work together to survive without attracting attention
yeah.
from the horrible things. So the production actually had an American Sign Language choreographer on staff.
Ooh, cool. I was going to say, the actors would have had to learn.
Yeah, and Millicent Simmons, the actor playing Reagan, is deaf in real life and knows American Sign Language and pitched in to help her fellow cast members learn the language.
Great.
I learned something about American Sign Language I didn't know before, which is that it is an original language with its own grammar. It's not just signs to represent English words necessarily. It has its own structures. It's not just a kind of gesture code to stand in for English. It actually has its own.
Do you know if that's structures. The same with British Sign Language?
I have no idea, I'm afraid.
Oh, how exciting. Well, sidebar, for Frankie Fightwell, the first night is going to be accompanied by British Sign Language. So maybe I can ask our lovely sign man.
Yep.
That's not the official term, is it? Hello, Mr. Sign Man. Just asking.
Sign language interpreter?
Maybe. <Yeah. laughs> I think it's BSL interpreter. But yeah, Russell. We call him Russell rather than Sign Man. Maybe I'll ask him.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah.
So the movie has minimal dialogue, and what dialogue there is, sort of 90% of it is in sign language, and only very small amounts of it are spoken aloud in English. And I don't think anybody speaks aloud for about the first hour.
Yeah.
Something like that. And when it does happen, it is kind of jarring. Like you have this, you've got so used to it, even just in an hour of time, that you get this reaction in the back of your head going, no, don't do that.
Yes.
It's dangerous. It's
and also, what are voices, please? Yeah,
yes. What do voices sound like again? I was surprised that the first time you hear characters talk that they're not like incredibly hoarse.
Yes, like when you wake up gravelly. In the morning.
Yeah. So that there's it's interesting the way that it deals with disability or the deafness of the character, because there is a trope in media, stories, movies, books that deal with apocalypse scenarios, mid-apocalypse, as it were. Anything dealing with apocalypses or collapse of society, the easy assumption that a lot of creators and writers make is that people with disabilities wouldn't survive.
First to go.
So people with disabilities are generally erased from that kind of story.
Yeah, people with disabilities, virgins, anyone going off on their own, and anyone who's not white.
Yeah.
Right? They're the first to get killed off in all these films.
Yeah, or it is implied that they are because they just don't appear.
Yeah.
People just don't write
certainly them. With disability, that is entirely the case.
Whether it's intentional or not, it can't be a very nice message to receive as a person with disability.
No. Zero representation.
Yeah, that you are in some way kind of weaker than the rest of society and just less capable of surviving. So it's nice that a Quiet Place kind of functions as a quiet rebuke to that kind of lazy storytelling.
And if anything, I'd have thought the disabled community would be the most adept at adapting to ongoing threat, having to do that all the time.
Yeah, adapting to forms of society that are not necessarily geared to making things easy for them.
Yeah.
So kind of inevitably, given the premise of the movie that it's a world where you can't make sound, it has a very strong theme or motif running through it of things being left unsaid.
Yeah.
And people not talking about things that they really ought to communicate about.
Yeah.
The whole situation with the monsters functions as this nice, neat kind of metaphor of, like, the fear of if something is spoken aloud, it will cause you pain or cause someone damage. But it also deals with just the general oppressiveness of being forced to live in silence. So there's nothing wrong with silence per se, and especially when you have the situation that the family in the movie have, where silence doesn't mean that they can't communicate. But there's something about the constant threat of, if you make a sound, you will be brutally killed, that just sort of naturally ends up having this cooling effect and suppressing effect on communication. It makes everybody kind of withdraw into themselves. And it really thinks through the depths of the horror of this situation. Like the horror movie structures of it really help to talk about exactly why this would be terrible. Because you can't cry out if you get hurt. You can't cry if you get sad. if you need help or if you want to warn somebody else about something, you can't call out. Even when you're happy, you can't laugh.
Yeah.
It's just, it makes you think about how much you use your voice, even if it's not actually words,
yeah,
to express emotion, and how the fact that you can't do that leads to everything being kind of bottled up and suppressed. There's so many shots in this movie of characters kind of shaking with some kind of emotion with their hand over their mouth. Emily Blunt especially, I think, is especially expressive.
Oof.
Kind of just through her facial expressions and body language alone. I mean, we hinted earlier at the fact that it tackles the issue of how do you take care of a newborn baby that doesn't know that it's not supposed to cry.
Yeah, guys, she goes through some stuff. She goes through some serious stuff.
Mm. She really does. And she has... So she, you have a nice contrast between her and John Krasinski as the dad, that she... Her body language and facial expressions are all very quite open, whereas he is very tense all the time and very contained, which kind of goes towards something that I thought was slightly less good about the movie, which is that they do seem to have, they've fallen back on into nuclear family sort of
gendered roles.
So yeah. John Krasinski is beardy survival dad,
yeah,
stoic survival dad who doesn't express his love, whereas Emily Blunt as the mum is the, like, the caretaker, the homemaker, the one who does the kind of educating the kids, that kind of thing.
So the only thing I would say in possible defence of that is that, because as you mentioned, she may be dealing with some newborn child issue, she may not physically be able to undertake all of the kind of man with beard traditional outdoors tasks.
Yeah.
At the period of time we're watching the film.
Yes, it definitely makes sense that she would not be the person going out, like, getting stuff where the monsters are hunting.
Hunt and shoot and fishing.
Yeah.
It's not what you do.
In her condition.
In her condition.
As people say.
Indeed.
And also I wondered whether there's, whether it's, I don't know whether this is me just being too kind to it, that it's saying something about that kind of family structure is a kind of an unspoken norm. And that maybe when communication breaks down to a certain extent, that the unspoken norms of society are what kind of surface again.
Yeah, because it's sort of that that old adage of old, like, during war or like economic downfall, people go back to the kind of cozy, familiar, historical setups.
It's a very homespun life that they're living apart from the monsters.
Yeah, it's just like when the hipsters brought back knitting.
Yeah. So, yeah, overall, such a good and tense experience.
Yes.
Really recommend seeing it on a big screen, if possible, I think. You have to kind of judge whether the audience is going to be your kind of audience for this kind of thing.
Yeah, so before we record, I was telling Matt that... So I did go and see this, and I chose a time when I knew that there would be very few people there because I was so afeard of the popcorn-snarfing, tittery, chatty people that might ruin the experience of what is, at least in part, a very quiet and silent movie.
Yeah. Although silence doesn't necessarily mean that there's no sound at all.
And no, it doesn't. So, tell us, Matt. What does it mean?
So I just wanted to name check the Michael Borowski, the sound mixer for this movie.
Well done, Mike.
Who has mixed many different types of silence in this movie.
Yeah.
There's a when you saw it, did you experience a kind of like a ringing in the ears kind of whine? Because I was trying to work out whether that was my own ringing in my own ears,
that
or whether that's
at
part
points,
of the yeah,
particularly like after moments of trauma.
Yeah,
in the film.
So it's mixing different kinds of silence where that is sound in the background, but it is low level, and then the contrast when I think that I don't know whether it's just the effect of it being silent for so long and then there being a loud thing, but the loud, violent sounds do seem to have been, like, pushed up and made harsher in the mix as well, which is a really great effect.
It's definitely very, very cleverly done. The only time I kind of thought about it was when it appeared to be silent, and then I really listened, and I realised there was sort of a low, ominous tone, on an undercurrent.
Yeah,
so it's really cleverly done.
Yeah, pay attention to every creaking floorboard and rustling corn and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. No, it's great. I would really recommend it as well. Excellent. Pointless question. Any idea what you might be doing next time?
I do, actually.
Oh my god.
It'll definitely be Avengers Infinity War next. because I know when I'm seeing it and I know when we're recording the next one of these.
I'm very
excited. All works out.
Okay, awesome. I will endeavour to see it before also. So, as always, if anyone wants a particular film from history, from all time, or an upcoming film of the future, which includes the phrase all time, then you can request it. You can tweet us at Blackshaw Update or even the Booth himself at Matt Boothen. So, coming up next, we have a very interesting task that we gave Stratton Alex. This is, of course, Stratton Alex Do Art.
Stratton Alex Do Art.
Yes, art.
Oh, I mean, it looks lovely, mate.
Well, here we are. It's time for another segment of your arting.
Mm-hmm. Arting about.
You are arting about, like, proper arts. Today, we are doing the noble art of set design, as Matt Boothman has dubbed it. So, we're making it themed around the show that we've got coming up.
Which, what show's that, Ellie?
Well, Matt Boothman, I'll tell you. It's The Final Adventures of Frank Bidwell. Yeah. So, it's written by Chris Buxley. It's very good play, and in preparation, both Alex and Strat have read said play.
We have.
And they are going to be doing a set design and doing it as though we have unlimited budget and resources. So, the only limit is your imagination.
Oh, yeah, get to live in theatre-making fantasy land for half an hour.
So, Black Box Studio then.
Well, yeah. Whatever you like.
One chair,
and a dog.
If that's, if that's what you think would really fit the vision of the play, then yes.
Yeah.
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 Totally dress the dog up as one of the man spiders.
Yeah!
Yeah, so the show, for those that don't know anything about the show, is being performed by us as a radio play, but it could be performed, obviously, as a full-blown staged version with things other than just audio. And in fact, if you want to see actors doing the performances of audio, you can come and see the show and then you do get that experience, but without a big set design. So this is us filling in the gap for you.
We can bring the pictures along if you like.
Yes, just pin them up at the front. Lovely.
I was thinking of walking around like one of those round the people at the
In the boxing.
In the boxing, yeah. Just walking around with the pictures.
Are you going to do it in like one of the
outfits? Bikinis, yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean,
any excuse.
Yeah.
I've bought it now, so...
So I'm wearing it.
Listeners, he's wearing it now.
Fashion design's not till next
time. Oh, that's a good idea, actually.
He's auto-lost.
Oh, no.
Auto-lost. So, the show itself is about an author, Stuart, writing another instalment of his series, Frankie Fightwell. And this heroine has gone through lots of different monsters and baddies, and she's fought robot laser sharks and all sorts. And now Stuart's agent's putting pressure on to make this one a good one because sales have been dropping. And he actually suggests that he's going to have to kill off his heroine in order to do that. So you get to see the interactions between Stuart and his agent, and later his daughter, but also his heroine, Frankie Fightwell, and Victor, the baddie in the book that he's writing. So it's very exciting. It's very silly. Her main enemy in this book is Nazi man spiders.
Classic.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really lending itself to whimsy, surrealism. You know, you really can let your imagination run wild. So I'm looking forward to seeing what you come up with. You've got materials. You've got half an hour. And that's on the basis that you've both read the script and you've maybe had a little bit of time to do some thinking.
Yes.
Out of interest, for the benefit of the folks at home, is that the sort of brief that you would give as a designer, as director of a show?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Well, no, normally I would meet with a set designer, we would talk about the script and maybe we would know what venue we were in by then. So a lot of it would depend on where we're performing, and
how the director sees the show. So it could be to do with how many cast members there are, what big scenes there are in the show, the overall look that you want to go for. So these are the kinds of things that I'm hoping you guys will be able to talk us through when you show us your designs. Kind of, we want to see you having thought about the themes of the piece,
mm-hmm.
Any big action scenes and how the set's going to accommodate those,
mm-hmm.
Maybe any reflections of character in the set, and how specific items of set will work.
Question.
Yeah.
Do we have to worry about spoilers?
Good question. Let's say no, and then if I need to in the edit go back and bleep stuff out, I will.
Excellent. That's cool.
Okay. It's like 1984, but good 1984.
Yeah, good censorship.
Yeah.
For your own good.
Or I can just do a big like honk for spoilers, either side of the spoiler. Yeah. Don't worry, audience, you'll be fully warned so that when you come and see the show, you can maintain this element of surprise. Okay, any more questions about how this is going
to
work?
I don't think half an hour. We've got to draw it, presumably.
And you've got to be able to talk us through
We've got to be able to talk us through it. Yeah. And we have unlimited budget resources.
Yes, and you can choose a venue that exists, or you can just be using an imaginary venue. It's up to you.
Awesome.
Okay?
Yes.
All right, your time starts now.
The Blackshaw Art Hour.
Ooh, that's a tasty treat.
Well, we'll check in again a bit later to see how they get on with that. In the meantime, we've got some very exciting interviews that the lovely Helen Stratton did with the cast and crew of Frankie Fightwell.
Would you please introduce yourself and confirm your role in Frankie Fightwell?
I'm John Raymond, and I'm playing Stuart, who is a writer who writes young adult literature featuring the character of Frankie Fightwell.
My name is Tom Slatter, and I play Dominic, who is the agent to Stuart. I'm a bit smarmy and a bit sort of selfish, and I'm basically coming to try and encourage Stuart to finish his book series because I want to make loads of money. and then there's a villain of the piece. He is one of the characters in Stuart's books. And I have, as Victor, have created Nazi man spiders.
Nice.
Yes.
Obviously.
So. Yeah, as you do.
Yeah, haven't we all?
Yes.
I am Abigail Morgan, and I am playing Frankie Fightwell. She is the main character, the heroine in the books that Stuart, the writer, is writing about. So she's basically in his imagination, which is great to explore her side of being in the books when she's a heroine and she's brave, and then her sassy self when she talks to Stuart, and she gets to, it's really fun because it's like two completely different sides.
I'm Chris Buxey, and I'm the writer of Frankie Fightwell.
How exciting.
I'm Andrew, I'm one of the Foley guys.
And I'm Megan, and I'm one of the interns.
Right, so we are talking just after the read-through has been done. How are you feeling about having actually heard it?
It's really exciting to hear it all come to life for the first time. It's a really exciting feeling. Looking forward to seeing it come together or hearing it come together even more over the next few weeks.
I thought it was so cool because it's the first time I've heard it. And I really enjoyed it.
Great.
Yeah, and it's really great hearing it with some of the actors, because I've read through it before and tried to figure out where to put the sounds in, but then suddenly hearing like the acts, all the characters brought to life in that way. Yeah. I just can't wait to get back in there and start playing around with stuff.
It's lovely to see all the gaps filled in.
Yeah.
And a lot more detail about who Stuart is and who Frankie is and all the other characters, which I won't let on. That would be spoiling the story. But yes, it's been lovely. And it's a lot funnier. I mean, the original was funny, but this is even funnier because it's going to be a radio play, which is great.
Great. Have you done much radio drama before?
We did a radio play whilst I was at drama school.
Yeah.
But since then, Foley-wise, no. So I'm really intrigued and I'm excited to sort of... But I do voiceovers and animation and stuff like that, which is a lot about using your voice to... express what's going on, even if you're not physically doing it, I guess.
Yeah, I've done some. So I've done audiobooks for the RNIB, and I have done some radio plays for the Wireless Theatre Company, and I've done stuff for Wireless Radio. Wireless Radio and Roundhouse Radio as well. So.
Great. You were rudely interrupted by Tilly, regular guest of the Blackshaw Arts Hour.
A little bit, but nothing on this scale. Not with proper live Foley before.
No, it's going to be so much fun.
Oh, it is.
I'm surprised you've not done loads of radio.
I do a lot of voiceover.
Yes.
But I've not done actual radio plays.
Cool. Much. Well, that makes sense to me. I think you have the second best storytelling voice that I've ever heard.
You're very kind.
First one is my dad, so I think you've done really well.
I'm very flattered. Thank you.
No, this is my first thing, my first piece specifically for radio.
Yeah. Tell me the story of how that came about. It's a weird one.
Well, this started with one of the Blackshaw's new writing nights. I submitted a piece for that, obviously Frankie Fightwell, that I originally envisaged as a stage piece. But after the new writing night, Ellie approached me about putting Frankie Fightwell on as a full show, because at that point it was just an opening scene. And once I'd written the full script, we looked at it and realised that actually it really sort of lent itself well to radio, or could, you know, potentially lend itself well to radio, especially because it was sort of quite reliant on some of the sound effects in places to create the sort of the atmosphere and the story. So when Ellie suggested that, I realised that was actually sort of quite correct, and I sort of rewrote the whole piece, and well, adapted it to make it sort of specifically for radio at that point.
Have you done much Foley before?
Never. First time.
Oh, it's exciting! Andy, have you done anything like this before?
Only last year, but that's just the once. Yeah.
What was your favourite sound last year?
Oh, I really enjoyed doing rain, but there's no rain in this one, so I'm going to have to try and find a new sound effect.
Cool.
That's my fave. Yeah. Because for last year, for the rain, what we did, we filled up a tub full of water, put a balloon in the water, and then just put a watering can on top of it, and it sounded exactly like rain.
It sounded it was beautiful. So good. And it looked so good. That's why it's so good to have a ticket and come and see the recording, because seeing how the sounds are made, I just think it's really fun, and you're going to have a great time doing it.
When I did the play at the Roundhouse Radio, I wasn't involved in the Foley, but there was live Foley going on.
Have you done much with Blackshaw before?
I have done about two of their scratch nights.
Yeah.
And I actually think one was not long after I'd graduated drama school, which is coming up 5 years now.
Uh-huh.
I think it was one of the first things I did since leaving drama school. So it's great that I'm still working with them. Still got a relationship with them. It's great.
I worked with Blackshaw once before, twice before. Originally with their production of Gormenghast.
Yeah.
Some years ago. I played Barkentine, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And then beginning of last year, Frankie Fightwell appeared as a scratch night performance.
Yeah.
And Ellie got in touch and said, would I be interested in taking part in that? And I said yes. And then she said, would I like to do it again for the radio play version? And I said yes again.
Brilliant. Well, it's coming together really well. We've got a bit of background noise of Foley practice happening, and obviously Tilly is making herself known. I wanted to ask you, because you are exceptionally busy, you work full time, and you have a family at home, is there a tip that you can give us about finding the time or using the time that you have for writing really well?
Yeah, I think the trickiest bit with writing, I find, is to literally do the first sentence, basically.
Yeah.
Once I've started, it's always fine, but I know a lot of other writers find the same. It's sort of sitting down to actually get started. So all you really need, to my mind, is the discipline to sit down and write one sentence. And once you've written that, then you're just away for the rest of it. You can write the rest quite easily. Well, that's what I find anyway. So it's easier to discipline yourself. You think, well, I'm just going to sit down and write at least one line. And then it sort of goes from there. But yes, you're right. I do have to sort of squeeze it in around other sort of work and family commitments. So normally I end up writing sort of late at night after everyone else has gone to bed.
Great. Okay. Now that is a simple and elegant
thing. Just, you know, just get cracking when you can and take it from there.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Great.
Thank you. I am here with someone that regular listeners will know extremely well. Would you please introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Ellie Pitkin.
And what is your role in Frankie Fightwell?
I am the director and producer.
Excellent. So we did Miss McSkimming together last year.
We did.
Tell us the thing you enjoyed the most about that and maybe the thing you learned that's going to be the most helpful with this.
I think the thing I actually most enjoyed was performing. Because I hadn't done it for so long and I played a number of characters in Miss McSkimming. Obviously I'm not actually acting in this one, but I love the kind of the more ensemble approach that there is to this kind of production with the Foley involvement, because you kind of have to have the Foley involved from the get-go. And I'd say actually that links into what my biggest lesson learned for this one is, which is that we didn't have Foley really involved in the first rehearsal.
Yeah.
We only had the voice acting. And it's actually been really useful to have Foley be part of the discussion right from the start, because what you actually find out after doing a production with Foley is that a lot of the sound effects are going to be a mixture of Foley and voice.
Yeah.
So the earlier you can get the two married together and work out which sound effects are going to be a marriage of the two, the more able you are to work those together rather than having them planned sort of in two separate war rooms and then come together and then you inevitably have to adjust what you've done anyway. So that's been really good, actually. A big lesson learned there. So I think I was worried that the Foley team would kind of be sitting there with not much to do in that first rehearsal, but it's so valuable to have them hear the first iterations of the script and get to know the rhythm that it's performed in, to be able to then drop in their precise cues, because a lot of the cues will be kind of just knowing the feel of it.
Yeah.
So, and actually it meant that, no spoilers, but Andy's come up with some great kind of happening in the background noises and soundscapes that I don't think would have come about had he just come in on the second rehearsal and been like, okay, so here's my list. And I had to just work through the list.
Absolutely. I spoke to Chris a bit about the showcase and everything and how the script struck you as something that would work for radio.
Mm.
Can you talk a bit about what it was that leapt out at you?
What I thought was really funny was that when I put the idea to Chris, he seemed really taken aback that it would be suitable for radio.
Yeah.
You know, will they understand what's happening? There's so much visual stuff that happens. And I just thought, no, there's not. When I'd first read the script, one of the sort of opening bits was talking about the sounds that were being made by the Nazi man spiders. The scuttling and the clicking and the sound of the mandibles and a lot of it is very much what you can hear. So all that had to happen is, rather than telling the audience that that's what they could hear, we could just create those sounds and have them be there. And it meant that that Andy had really great sort of descriptions to go with for the sounds that needed to be created. So for me, it just seemed obvious that it would work really well as a radio play, because Chris had written descriptions of the sound so vividly, which I haven't really come across before in a straight play script. So I think he just accidentally wrote a radio play.
That's so funny. Like the sort of contradictions in each of your approaches.
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I've had a brilliant day at the rehearsal. Good. And they're all such terrific voice actors.
Yeah.
I just can't wait to see it all come together a
Me
bit
neither.
More. It's going to be great.
Go on, treat yourself to something.
Subscribe to the Blackshaw Arts Hour on your generic podcast resource.
You deserve it.
There you go. If that's not a truly exciting warm-up and a brilliant thing to make you want to go and do see in a play, I don't know what is.
So now shall we check in and see what sort of set they might be performing on in an ideal world?
Yeah, in an ideal world, if we do a big old show, let's see what small and intimate venues Strat and Alex might have picked. Here we go.
Strat and Alex do art.
Right, well, we're back with Alex and Strat. They've been done doing some arts in the form of a set design.
Mm-hmm.
The pencils have been scritching on the paper.
There's a chaotic artistic energy in the room.
Yeah, it's been frenetic. And, you know, we've been really witnessing the birth of something wonderful, I think.
Yeah.
You don't look confident.
It was one of our more sedate ones, actually.
Yeah.
I don't think either of us swore.
Well, that's good.
We didn't come close to cutting ourselves.
No.
Or each other.
That's never happened, has it?
I've come too close to cutting myself.
Okay.
With the potato one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, Christ, yeah, no.
No, just pencils this
pencils.
Time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Safety pencils.
Yes. Those kinds with the special grips that you give children. Like,
they blunted the tips,
and we've given you those special little grips so that you hold the pencil correctly,
mm-hmm.
with like an animal's design on it so that you like it. Yeah, good. So, who would like to go first?
I'll go first.
Okay, so obviously we'll be posting pictures of these online, but Alex, be as descriptive as you can in your description.
Right, so okay, I'll start with a venue. I've gone for an arena. Something like off of the O2.
Yeah, sure. I think you mean the, what's it called? The Millennium Building.
The Millennium Building.
It's called the O2.
The Millennium Building.
Good. Other podcast reference.
Yeah. Nice. Millennium Dome Building. Yeah. No walks under seats here. No. So
all the audience members will get a free walk and...
And a show to watch, which would be a delight. So you've got the main sort of thing that I've chosen to do is put all the audience on some of the upper tiers. So the lower tiers will be emptied, pushed back. So there is a large arena floor.
Oh, so almost like a gladiators.
Gladiatorial arena. Mm-hmm. In the centre, so looking down straight on top of the arena, you'll be able to see a suspended cage where Stuart's... office will be...
Okay, the writer.
Writer, yeah. So his office will be in there, and that will be able to be raised and lowered, and there will be a gantry running to and from it for exits and entrances by his by other characters that come and visit Stuart.
Okay.
Yes, visitor's platform.
I'm imagining like the cage where they keep Magneto in X-Men.
Yeah. Oh, you've nailed that one. Not plastic, though. I'm thinking cast iron bars. Sure. He doesn't have magnetic powers. He's stuck. There's obviously a door, just as a FYI on that cage. But around the arena, there'll be screens, because obviously it's a much larger area. People will be able to need to see certain things. So there'll be cameras that will be able to... So it's more of a live show than anything else. I just thought for the big fight scenes, having it in an arena would be like really, really good fun.
Yeah.
Because then you could actually have big mechanical spiders chunking around and running around after Frankie as she fights around in the pit below.
Yeah.
So there's like communication between her and Stuart, the writer, via the screens as well.
Okay. So they have some kind of comms to
catch
them.
Because and I think I like the idea of the writer being isolated and both parties being isolated, because that's kind of, for me, that was one of the things that I pulled out, was like, he's very alone,
right?
And he is very alone in the middle of an arena.
And why is he trapped? What's that got to do with in the script?
Well, he's trapped because he's got to write a book, and he's trapped because he doesn't know how to finish it,
right? Okay.
And he doesn't know what to do with the ending.
Trapped in the cage of emotion.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not glass cage in this.
Right.
In this
no,
case.
No, no. You said iron bars.
It's iron bars, so people can see in and out. I mean, people can see through glass as well, but it's reflective.
Yeah.
So
sure.
You know, for the lighting.
Yeah.
So inside Stuart's office, I've done a little design for that. It's quite cramped, quite small, quite cluttered. There'll be a desk and a plate with a cup on it as well, and a computer and a chair, so all that sort of stuff. So quite small and quite simple.
Yeah, sure.
But you'll be able to see, I wanted like sort of CCTV style footage of him in there, like you're almost like watching a prisoner.
Yeah.
So that's just his little office, and that'll be raised and lowered. And then the final denouement, that'll come right down onto the arena floor, and he'll come out.
Right.
So he'll be out of his cage.
Yeah.
So that's...
Will he play the killer's sign?
Yes, well done. Well done. Oh, that's beautiful.
That's class.
So around the arena floor, there'll be some Nazi flags.
Yeah.
Oops.
Just to say, that is part of the play. That's
there are Nazi
themes.
Not just my idea.
It's not just that Alex has gotten really weird.
Every play I do just has to have one Nazi flag in it.
Just for one.
Just
but
for
you've
one.
Gone with several this
I've
time.
Gone for several. It's a larger space.
Yeah.
Ellie,
you don't want people to miss them.
Clip that sound bite for Alex's show reel.
There'll be tunnel entrances into the arena for Frankie to come through.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed any sort of
attackers, Nazi spiders, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
There'll be a little platform for the evil villain, the arch villain, Victor.
Oh, I thought that said visitor's platform. I thought that was how you visited his cage. But that's Victor's platform.
Victor's platform. He'll have two statues of Hitler either side.
Oh, wow. You're going really out there with the Nazi thing.
Well, it's in the title.
No, it's not.
The title is The Final Adventure of Frankie Fightwell. Not Nazi, Nazi, Nazi.
Nazi man spiders not mentioned at all?
Yeah, they are.
But oh, there really you go.
In the blurb.
Oh, fine. Anyway, but he's a Nazi. It's like, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So that'll be there.
We want to really remind the audience at every opportunity
that he's evil and he's a Nazi.
There are Nazis in the show. Yeah.
Yeah.
Why
not?
Calling him Victor von Fascist wasn't enough.
No. You need to really drive the point home. Also, it's a big arena, so people might not see, so you've got to make it all clear.
Yeah, yeah, so you've gone for flags and two statues of Hitler to just make it really clear. Yeah. Good, good.
So, the tunnel, like, Frankie, not spoiler alert, obviously, has already been done, but Frankie's entrance through the tunnel will be pre-recorded and put up on the screens.
Yeah.
And then she'll walk out into the main arena, and then the cage will be highlighted, so it's kind of like a reveal. But that's my design. Any questions?
No, I think that's pretty comprehensive. You've signposted it well.
Good.
Yeah, it's a very legible design.
Yes.
I like the, you know, the different elevations so that we can see how it's going to work.
I like the dangling prison thing. Yeah.
Cool, but you're not too sold on the Nazi memorabilia.
I wouldn't expect anyone to be sold on Nazis.
I mean,
necessarily.
I think it fits the text. We're just going to have to keep a tight lid on social media so that things don't get leaked.
So we don't...
Here's Blackshaw's show and some Nazi flags.
Yeah.
I mean, it's 2018,
People take that out of context.
They might.
Yeah.
They might. Unless we'd make it clear that we don't like the Nazi flags. It's just a picture of our cast with, like, thumbs down.
Boo! Nazis! Boo!
Yeah, make it really clear.
Yeah.
Fab. Cool. Strat, can you talk us through yours, please?
I can. So I kind of have two pictures before and after.
Because there's a set change.
Well, it's more of a set transformation.
Oh! Ooh. Fancy pants.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So I have decided we're going to be at the Olivier.
Okay, sure.
Why not? So it's kind of got this wide with kind of, you know, it's I don't know what...
It's like it's a bit like an eight. It's well, it's based on a Greek amphitheatre.
Yeah, it's got that curved front of the stage.
A curved apron at the
curved apron. That's exactly what it is. So at the beginning of the play, where it's very much Stuart, the writer, by himself. So I've kind of created his little flat, and the idea is it would be like forced perspective going back. So it's going to look very kind of like tiny at the bottom to kind of bring everything to the front and kind of create a sort of claustrophobic feeling of this room.
Yeah.
I wanted him to be writing in essentially his living space.
Uh-huh.
I didn't want him to kind of have his own like little writing sanctuary or anything. So I kind of wanted to give the idea that this is probably a flat, probably just one bedroom.
Yeah.
To kind of put over his kind of situation. Just like lots of kind of books and clutter. I haven't been able to draw all of it. Kind of a sofa, a sort of TV, a little fish tank. With some little fish to keep him company.
That's nice.
Because he probably wouldn't want to have sort of like a cat or anything. Pet. Yeah, he wouldn't be able to. He wouldn't be very good at that.
I don't like fish. Carry on.
Yeah, and
so we're quite naturalistic at this point. Other than the false perspective.
So there's I wanted to kind of keep it naturalistic, but some sort of otherworldliness, like.
Yeah,
something kind of
a bit
wrong.
Skewed. Yeah.
And there's also this kind of spider web up here, and this sort of spider web down here.
Clever.
Bit of signalling going on.
Yeah.
And obviously his desk here faces the audience, so the audience becomes like literal kind of fourth wall as though it were kind of up against that. And there's an entrance stage right, which would be kind of the front door.
Yeah.
And there where. Some people can enter and exit. Yes. Who is it? Rachel and
Dominic.
That's it.
Yeah.
And then a single door going out there. And now the idea is
stage left.
Yes, sorry, stage left
to the bedroom,
to the kitchen, probably the hallway,
right,
to the other bits of the flat. So that would be kind of where it begins. And then, as the play progresses, the entire space begins to transform as he and Frankie kind of get delve deeper into the world that he is creating, and his kind of anchor on what is real and what is not starts to disintegrate. So that by the end of the play, and we obviously have these quite dramatic, can we say it?
There's a very dramatic thing
where perhaps he has completely...
He's lost his grip.
Lost his grip on what is Frankie and what is not. We find ourselves an audience looking at something more like that. So, the entire set was kind of like confined to like central stage. And as it, as the play goes on... Yeah, like a box set rather than using the full width. So as the play goes on, the everything essentially, if you imagine, like it's stretched out. So the side walls will come right to the side of stage, the back... Now, maybe isn't looking quite so forced perspective because it's not going quite down as much to a point, so it's kind of opened out. And everything in the room transforms into something that you would find in the caverns. So
In
the caverns underneath, the caves underneath.
Where Frankie's exploring in the story.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the doors would round out and transform into tunnels. Coats would suddenly be covered up by these stalagmites that are coming up here. The fish tank would flip round to reveal these kind of vats with spider eggs in them. The TV at the back here, that would sort of like start to morph into like the control console that Victor von Fascius have. The two spider webs would be some sort of elasticy thing, so as the walls moved out, they would stay in place but stretch and become much larger their size.
Yeah.
And the whole of the kind of the back, that the kind of rug that you had in the centre, that would kind of be pulled up from these kind of downstage corners to, on its underside, reveal two spider swastikas using their legs to do the thing. And this crudely drawn portrait in the middle here of Victor von Fascist, who I've given an eye patch because... He is a fascist.
Oh, I think we're straying a little bit into costume design there.
A little bit, but I think it's important for the set, so...
You can argue with the costume design.
Exactly. And then the sofa has kind of is going to have turned into like a little pile of rocks there, so that when we have all the kind of dramatic fights, there's sort of like a much bigger arena, and then right at the end, when there is this sudden realisation of, oops, I've made a big mistake, the set can very, very quickly this time... transform back into
what
it was into its reality. So it slowly becomes this kind of cavern across the thing, and then in the confusion and the madness of the final fight, it can all shrink back down to that, and we're left back where we were.
Some clever mechanics behind the scenes, then.
Some incredibly clever mechanics behind the scenes, yes.
Stagecraft at its finest.
Yes.
Great.
We're going to hire the same people that did Harry Potter and the Cursed Child.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because magic...
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure it's all doable.
Well, I think both designs are great, and interesting that you both wanted like an arena feel, particularly for those more dramatic elements and fights towards the end.
Hmm.
What are your thoughts, Matt?
Do you want me to start tending in a direction?
I want you to start judging these mofos.
So I'm leaning towards Alex's arena. For basically sheer ambition, and because I can picture it quite easily, and I feel like it would be kind of a like an iconic and memorable thing, seeing this like office in a cage hanging from the ceiling.
Yes. Yeah, I'm leaning in the other direction.
Okay,
I really like the kind of clever transformation of things that's included in Strat's design. I'm a real sucker for a thing that becomes another thing. So I think we're going to maybe have to put this one out to public vote.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Oh,
here we are again.
No, I've not done well in the public vote. The mercy.
We've both won one.
Have there been two?
Yeah.
We've won one each.
Really?
Yeah. So lies. It clearly means as well that you didn't bother to vote for yourself, which you could have done.
God damn it.
This time.
I think that's kind of cheating.
No, it's not. Politicians do it.
Oh, yeah, good point.
Not that they're a paragon for ethics. So what we'll do is we'll put this out on Twitter and Facebook, and we will allow the general public to vote for their favourite design. And that will be how it's decided, because Matt and I cannot come to an agreement.
Yeah, and whichever one wins, if we ever do get an unlimited grant for Frankie Fightwell, you have to use it.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. Book the O2 now. The Millennium Building.
Yeah. Good. Okay, lovely. Well, thank you very much, both of you. And everybody, get your eyes onto our social media and vote for your favourite. Great, well, there you go. The public vote will be opened up very shortly, so keep an eye on our Twitter and our Facebooks, and you can do a vote on Stratton Alex as to which set design you prefer.
Yeah, which one would you want to experience in real life?
Boy, howdy, would they be an experience. Great, well, get voting, and we will reveal the winner of the vote in the next episode. Do tune in again next time. This has been the Blackshaw Arts Hour, and we've been doing an art and chatting about it. And I've been Ellie, and you've been...
Matt.
Great, nice to meet you. See you next time.
See ya.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Blackshaw Arts Hour.
Follow us on Twitter at Blackshaw Update.
Watch us on the Instagrams at Blackshaw Theatre.
Like us on the Facebook at Blackshaw Online.
And find all the things at blackshawonline.com.